loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet in Helsinki, Finland on July 16th. This will be the first meeting between the two leaders. Trump said that Syria, Ukraine, and, quote, many other subjects, unquote, would be on the agenda. And he added that, quote, getting along with Russia, China, and everybody else is a good thing. Next, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray testified before the House Judiciary Committee this morning about the DOJ Inspector General's report of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. Republicans demanded access to sensitive documents used in the investigation, and Democrats demanded that the Republicans be denied those documents. In the middle of the testimony, they all broke to vote on a House resolution demanding the documents. Then, two new reports by the UK's Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committees reveal that Britain's MI6 Foreign Intelligence Service and MI5 Domestic Intelligence Service were linked to hundreds of cases of rendition and torture, along with the United States, in the years following the September 11th attacks. Former Foreign Secretary Jack Straw will likely face tough questions about what he knew and when he knew it. And then Angela Merkel is in trouble. The German Chancellor's coalition partner has threatened to withdraw from the government if she doesn't solve Germany's immigration crisis by this weekend, while Italy's new populist government said that it would not accept any refugees back from Germany. Merkel said today that if an immigration agreement isn't hammered out this weekend, the very future of the European Union is in doubt. And finally, Chinese President Xi Jinping told visiting U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis that China, quote, will not give even 1 inch of territory, unquote, in the Pacific Ocean. Mattis's meeting with Xi comes as relations between the two countries have been marred by a trade war and by both militaries viewing each other with suspicion. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet in Helsinki, Finland on July 16th. This will be the first meeting between the two leaders. Trump said that Syria, Ukraine, and, quote, many other subjects, unquote, will be on the agenda. And he added that, quote, getting along with Russia, China, and everybody else is a good thing. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is Sacrificing Gaza, the Great March of Zionist Hypocrisy. Jim, welcome back.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Jim, so what do you make of this this great summit? I mean, this ought to be happy news for everybody. And at least in the U.S. press, it's not.
The sky is falling, John. And you forgot. You failed to notice that.
Imagine that, a president of the United States meeting the president of another country.
Terrible.
You know, it's just we all know what the fears are and why there's a kerfuffle about it. And the Times of London had a perfect headline today. Fears growing over prospect of Trump, quote, peace deal with Putin. So, you know, what everybody's worried about is what happened with North Korea, that something will come out which will be relatively pacific and maybe lessen tensions and maybe lead to more normalized relations. And that's not what the quote-unquote deep state permanent government wants. They want to have keep the pressure up on Russia, keep the tension up, and the military the militarization of the relationship between the United States and Russia going.
Jim Cavanaugh is our guest. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. His most recent piece is Sacrificing Gaza, the Great March of Zionist Hypocrisy. Jim, real quick question. I mean, the Times of London says fears are growing. They must have done a poll, I guess, among people living in London who were getting scared that something was going to happen with the Trump-Putin meeting. Is that what happened?
I just see the headline on a Twitter feed. Someone did a screenshot. So I don't know what the article is, but I'm going to imagine that it was fears among the elite academics and politicians that the reporter spoke to about this, you know, because really, who's afraid of this? And, you know, it's just kind of nuts. And when you read, there was a thing that actually RT's thing, they have a tweet from some neocon saying about Bolton. They're saying now that Bolton must be a Russian agent.
He's a peacenik.
Great.
Because he's over there, you know, being nice to the Russians.
He's a stooge. Putin.
And they said, this guy said, if Bolton isn't bringing Putin back in handcuffs, what's he doing up there?
Oh, yeah. Because that should be the role of the National Security Advisor. Go to other countries with handcuffs and detain the head of state and bring them back to America. Of course.
Yeah. So now they're going to push to make sure, to try and push Trump to spend all day talking with Putin about Russian meddling in the elections. But let's not talk about Ukraine and Syria. And let's talk about Russian meddling in the – make sure that you get them on the record about this, Donald. You know, that's going to be the push. I mean, this is just – I don't know how – it's ludicrous. It's dangerous, though, also. And, you know, there are things we could look at here. From my perspective, maybe – you know, this might work out badly in a certain sense. You know, Trump might make a deal with Putin where Putin would back off on defending Syria in exchange for something else, or back off on the Palestinians in exchange for something else. You know, so there's something you could look at this that would be interesting to talk about, but Russian meddling and fears of a peace deal. I mean, and why should anybody go over there without putting him in handcuffs? This is just...
Yeah. I mean, Roosevelt met with Stalin twice. That would be Tehran and Yalta. He was gone. He died by the time of Potsdam. That was during World War II. Starting in 1955, Eisenhower met with Khrushchev before Khrushchev was head of state, but he was by then the leader of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Eisenhower met with Khrushchev four other times. And then if you go through all of all of those decades, you had John F. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan. Everyone met, all the heads of state met with their Soviet counterparts, or what would now be Russia following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, at the time of the Cold War, probably Eisenhower and Kennedy took a lot of heat for meeting with the evil empire. But nonetheless, it was considered a part of normal diplomacy to have
Absolutely.
Normal diplomatic relations.
And visits, mutual visits.
Yeah. And so, but here you have a situation that the thing has become so bizarre, so obscenely bizarre, such a witch hunt, that for Trump to go and meet with Putin is actually treated as some form of, you know, like an indicator that it's all true. That the Russians are really pulling the strings in the White House.
But don't forget, this was the attitude also during the George W. Bush administration. Condoleezza Rice worked so hard to not carry out diplomacy with other countries that it became almost the norm in the Republican Party.
But even still, remember, Bush looked into Putin's eyes.
And saw his soul.
He saw his soul. He liked him.
You know, your point about Kennedy is good because Kennedy was excoriated for the nuclear test ban treaty and for doing things from the right. But there was never any, I don't think there was an issue among the elite politics, political Republicans about him meeting with Khrushchev per se. Or, you know, Nixon, of course, Nixon going to China is the classic example of it. You know, you meet with heads of state, meet with other heads of state, they should. And the point is that what they're afraid of is peace breaking out, you know. And Trump is so impetuous that who knows what he'll come up with, that he will then kind of be committing the United States to stick to in some way. I did tweet after the North Korea summit, you know, I mean, Trump is now, I think, it's getting to the point where on the edge of my universe of thought, this is the kind of thing that really pees people off, you know? I mean, if you're going down this kind of road where you're making peace with countries we're supposed to be at war with, that's something they don't want to do, you know? And so he's got not just political elites of both parties after him, but now, you know, on the edges of this, if he's so impetuous and he makes a commitment to something that they really don't want to make a commitment to, he's in a lot of danger of them.
John Kiriakou and Jim Kavanaugh, remember how when Ronald Reagan sort of also impetuously said with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik,
yes,
that, yeah, let's both of our countries get rid of their nuclear weapons. And the whole Pentagon.
They went crazy.
They went nuts because they thought, like, okay, Reagan might be demented
uh-huh.
and might have just agreed to give up our nuclear arsenal impetuously. But anyway, they shut that down. And when you think about what's happened with Trump, I mean— we have the expulsion of Russians in large numbers, the shutting down of Russian consulates here, sending heavy weapons, really, advanced mm-hmm. weapons yep. to Ukraine to fight against people in the eastern part of Ukraine. And then the new national security strategy that Trump himself went out and he wanted to be the guy at the press conference, of course he did, announcing it, which where the Pentagon is preparing now for not a war against Al-Qaeda, but major power confrontation with Russia and China. When you look at the actual record, there's nothing soft about Trump and the Trump administration towards Russia. It's just that he's not on the far out maniacal place that the Democrats want him to be.
That's right. I wanted to ask Jim actually a similar question too. Jim, when Reagan first met Gorbachev in 1985, Reagan went to Moscow. And remember, he jumped out of the limousine and shook hands with people and the Russians loved him. It was a big love fest. And then Gorbachev came here in 1982 and did the same thing at Connecticut Avenue and K Street. He got out of the limo, shook hands, everybody took pictures. But nothing substantive came out of those first two meetings. It was only later on where substantive discussions took place. Should we expect anything concrete to come out of this first meeting?
You know, I'm going to say about this, what I said about Korea, I very much doubt it. I'll say 60-40 at least that this is not going to go anywhere. Very serious. You know, it's not going to there may be some marginal changes, but I think the people who are going to handle this are going to handle it and make sure that things get put on the table that cannot be accepted by the other side and that there won't be. I'd be very surprised if there were a major realignment that occurs because of either Korea or this. May happen, but I'm betting against it. And, you know, I think the deep state goes to work. And what you have is this bizarre problem, and it's one of the things they don't like, is that Trump says things that are, as you pointed out, just pointed out, Brian, his policy has been very tough and aggressive towards Russia, no matter what he says about Vladimir Putin or whether he likes him or doesn't like him. So Trump is saying things publicly that are in complete contradiction and obvious blatant contradiction with what the actual policy on the ground is in Europe and in Ukraine, as you say, there's serious military changes going on that are aggressive towards Russia. So my answer to you is I don't think so. My tendency is to think this is going to be handled and managed, and Trump will be tweeting what he wants to tweet. And once it comes down to setting up the deals, not just the statements, there'll be a nice statement just like there was with Kim that comes out of this with Trump. But at the end of the day, when they sit down over the period of months to hammer something out, they're going to push for things that the other side can't accept.
You know, Russia has the military budget that's 1/10. It's really less than 1/10 the size of the U.S. military budget. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, certainly the strategic allies of Russia in Central and Eastern Europe are gone. Big parts of the Soviet Union are now, in fact, incorporated, or at least some of them, into an American sphere of influence. When you look at the diminished influence of Russia, it's palpable. The idea that Russia is now on the march, spreading chaos, taking over America, under these circumstances, it's so ludicrous. And nonetheless, it becomes the political backdrop, the context for this meeting between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. As I'm saying, my fear is, in some sense, that Russia is liable to. They still want to have good relations with the United States. There are a group of liberal, Western-oriented Russian in the economy and the central bank who want to have better relations with the United States and are willing to give up things politically for it. And you know, Putin is someone in Russia who manages and compromises between factions. He's not the hard line. I don't think he's the hardliner that he's being posed here. He's someone who wants to keep things together in Russia and does want to be in a partnership with the United States.
And we're going to see that in the next 2.5 weeks. We're out of time, though. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net, whose most recent piece is called Sacrificing Gaza, The Great March of Zionist Hypocrisy. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray testified before the House Judiciary Committee this morning about the DOJ Inspector General's report of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. Republicans demanded access to sensitive documents used in the investigation, and Democrats demanded that the Republicans be denied those documents. In the middle of the testimony, they broke to vote on a House resolution demanding the documents. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks, guys.
Ted, this is a really partisan issue. The vote for these documents was expected to fall along partisan lines. Of course, it did. It had been co-sponsored by 19 Republicans, all members of the committee. And now the Justice Department is sort of on the hook to turn these documents over. Why are they so important? And why don't the Democrats want the Republicans to have them?
I'd like to answer the second question first, because we're in opposite land. There was once a time not long ago when Democrats were the ones who were calling for increased government congressional oversight over the intelligence community and over these kinds of operations, including the FBI. And now they don't want it. They're literally telling the world, we don't want to exercise our constitutionally mandated role as the people's representative over our own government agencies and police institutions. So that's weird. I just want people to like think about that and let that sink in a little bit, how far right the Democrats have drifted. Meanwhile, the Republicans, you can see why they want access to these documents. They just want to know, they want to put an end to it because we are heading into a midterm election. And if there's a report that comes out that's unfavorable to Trump, that could hurt the Republicans' chances this fall. And obviously, Trump's in 2 years. And they just want to bring an end to it, perhaps as soon as by exposing the documentation that's available. They just, you know, if you're being investigated, if your party's being investigated, you obviously have an interest in knowing what's in there. But the fact that they have a political and partisan self-interest doesn't really mean that they're wrong. But this is also opposite world, because Republicans traditionally have been on the opposite side of this this kind of debate. You know, it's a weird place we're in.
It is indeed. It's something that, well, as Ted points out, it's opposite land. There was a piece I saw on the Huffington Post. It's actually running everywhere. It's on Raw Story and HuffPo and the Washington Post and everything. The headline here on Raw Story is Internet laughs out loud after Republican quote unquote idiot tries to corner Rosenstein, but gets himself roasted alive instead. And what Ted's saying is true, that it's the Republicans attacking the Republican FBI director and the Republican deputy attorney general, and then just being schooled that they don't have their facts straight. And it's the Democrats who are jumping to support these two guys. It's, you know, the age of Trump. It's something that we really haven't seen before.
It's also funny. I mean, yeah. I mean, what got roasted is that his assertion that there needed to be a that he wanted to see subpoenas,
yeah,
of phone calls, and it was pointed out that it's not possible to subpoena a phone call. Of course, you know, that's all very funny and everything, but there's a more serious matter. I mean, in a sense, everybody's phone calls are being subpoenaed by the NSA every single day. And of course, obviously, there's a FISA court that is allowing the FBI to and the NSA to go in and scoop up and vacuum up everyone's phone calls, including, yes, the voice recordings of them, even though there were reports to the contrary that it was only the metadata. But I digress. The privacy issue doesn't seem to be something that has much survived Snowden and his revelations from a few years ago. But, you know, I mean, it's a weird place we're at. I mean, what we have here is also just such a conflict between the Trump branch of the Republican Party and the old traditional corporate Republican Party, which is also an interesting split.
Ted Rall is our guest. We're talking about the hearings, congressional hearings, where Rod Rosenstein and Christopher Wray, the new FBI director, he became FBI director after James Comey was fired by Donald Trump, are testifying. Again, let's just help the audience understand what just happened. In the middle of these hearings, the committee took a break. They went to a vote on the House floor, H.R. 970, insisting that the Department of Justice fully comply with the requests, including subpoenas of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the subpoena issued by the Committee on the Judiciary relating to potential violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act by personnel at the Department of Justice and related matters. Now, that, as we mentioned, that bill was brought to the House floor. It passed. 224 Republicans voted yes. 184 Democrats voted no. So a completely down-the-line partisan vote. Now, Representative King, again, Republican, again, we have the FBI saying no to the committee that's supposedly in charge of the oversight over the FBI, saying, no, we don't want to give you these documents. And you have the Democrats, as Ted is saying, everything's upside down. The Democrats are saying, no, please don't give us these documents. They're putting their hands over their ears, their hands over their eyes, hear no evil, see no evil, that kind of thing. So Representative Stephen King from Iowa said this, as much information as possible needs to have sunlight on it to make the public confident in this investigation. I would submit that there's no information that's in the executive branch that should be held from the people forever. Now, King then asked Rosenstein and Ray, what if the president directly ordered all information to be let out without any redaction? Rosenstein responded, Christopher Wray, the FBI director, and Coates, director of national intelligence, would consult with the president, so this may be the only way to get this information. That's what King said in response. So, yeah, let's talk about that, Ted. Can Trump just order this?
Well, I mean, I think he can order it. I think what that would be doing is escalating a constitutional crisis if the FBI were to refuse, or in a sense, even if they were to comply. Perhaps it's not really a constitutional crisis, but it's a governmental organizational crisis that we haven't seen the likes of. I think even under Watergate, there was nothing Nixon never ordered the FBI to release the results of their investigation, if I remember the scandal correctly. I could be mistaken on that, but I've read a lot about it. I don't think that happened then. So it's sort of it's like a mini constitutional crisis already, what has happened. The fact that you have this kind of dispute even occurring at the congressional level, if it's elevated to the executive branch, I mean, now you have two branches going after a subsidiary of the executive branch, and it's just it's crazy town. The investigation, I mean, look, I have to say this is, I find myself in this weird position of siding with the Republicans here.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
I want this stuff out, and I always side on the side of we should have more openness. We should have this is the people's money. We're paying for this investigation as taxpayers. The American people deserve to know what's going on, unless there's a very high level national security reason not to reveal it, which is probably extremely doubtful if history serves.
Yeah. And Ted, you know, the Democrats, the basic line of the Democrats in this hearing, when their counterparts, the Republicans, are demanding that the FBI hand over to the committee, that's the oversight committee, documents that would allow them, the oversight committee, to see it. The Democrats are saying they're getting down on their hands and knees before the FBI director and Rod Rosenstein, saying, thank you for your service. I disassociate myself from the conduct of my colleagues in quizzing you. Really? Like, we're not supposed to have the elected officials, supposedly of the people, quizzing the FBI?
That's what oversight means.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't even, we're not even talking about releasing this stuff to the media.
No.
Or anyone else. We're just talking, I mean, these are congressmen. These people are briefed on matters of extremely sensitive national security matters, like matters of war, raids, coups, all sorts of stuff. And if they can't be trusted to just look at these documents and promise not to leak them, then, I don't even know what that says. But that's not obviously what the Democrats are after here. The Democrats have pinned everything, all of their impeachment fantasies, on the Mueller investigation. And they don't want anything to throw a wrinkle in that, even though actually I think it's a chimera of a impeachment fantasy, because Nancy Pelosi has promised that there will be no impeachment, even if the Democrats take back both houses of Congress this fall. And not to mention, you can easily see why the Democrats would not want to impeach Trump anyway next year. I mean, I think we're going to end up with a big fat nothing burger in the form of a report when this is all over. That's it. We're going to get a report.
Yeah.
Rasmussen did a study, John, by the way. It's 1,000 likely voters. 31% of the people asked said that they expect the United States to have a second civil war in the next 5 years.
Great. That's great.
Well, that's why we've all been going to those reenactments, you know.
I think we're going to leave our listeners with that thought. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall. Ted's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, and you can check out his work at www.rall.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Two new reports by the UK's Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committees reveal that Britain's MI6 Foreign Intelligence Service and MI5 Domestic Intelligence Service were linked to hundreds of cases of rendition and torture along with the United States in the years following the September 11th attacks. Former Foreign Secretary Jack Straw will likely face tough questions about what he knew and when he knew it. We're joined from Urbana, Illinois, by Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law and author of the book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East Before and After September 11th. Dr. Boyle, welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on, my best to your listening audience.
So tell us the import of these two studies and why did it take so long for them to come out?
Well, of course, I haven't had a chance to read these studies. I have only read the story about them in the Guardian, which is, I take it as accurate. These studies are of seminal legal importance because without having read the studies, I believe the British lawyers could take these two studies and on the basis of these studies alone, file a complaint with the International Criminal Court for the activities mentioned in these two reports against Straw, Blunkett, the head of MI5, the head of MI6, and of course, Tony Blair at a minimum. Britain is a party to the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. This policy of extraordinary rendition that they were involved in constitutes torture and the enforced disappearance of human beings, both of which are crimes in the Rome Statute. And when they are widespread or systematic, and in this case, they are both widespread and systematic, they would constitute crimes against humanity. Now, I filed a similar complaint that I sent to you. You have it there against Bush and the top-level officials in his administration for their policy of extraordinary rendition with the International Criminal Court. And in the case of the United States, we are not even a party to the Rome Statute, but I was the first fellow to figure out that jurisdictional problem in that the Bush et al. Had committed Rome Statute crimes in Rome statutory states, and therefore the ICC had jurisdiction against them. Now, I did not file that complaint, however, just on the basis of news media accounts. Because first, as you know, you really can't rely on much of what you read in the mainstream news media today. And then second, technically, news media accounts are hearsay. So the gist, the element of my complaints, the factual basis, were reports produced by the Dick Marty Committee and his investigation that was set up by the Parliamentary Assembly for the Council of Europe. So I actually had official reports that were the evidentiary basis for my complaint, which is exactly what we have here now today.
We're speaking from Urbana, Illinois, with Professor Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and author of the book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East Before and After September 11th. Brian, this has the makings of quite a big scandal. We've already gone through this at the sort of tail end of the Bush administration. Barack Obama decided to walk away from it, really, and not prosecute anybody. What do you think the chances are of this getting even bigger in the UK and prosecutions coming out of it?
Well, yeah, Obama said, let's look forward. Let's not prosecute torturers. You, John Kiriakou, exposed the torture program and you went to prison. You were the only CIA person who went to prison for the torture program because you exposed it. But let's go back, though. There's more to this. You know, in 2009, an Italian court convicted 22 CIA operatives and a U.S. Air Force colonel on kidnapping charges because of the torture, because of the rendition and torture program whereby the CIA and CIA operatives were arresting, kidnapping, really, and torturing people from Italy. We also had the case where Donald Rumsfeld has been convicted in international or charges were brought against him in international courts, meaning non-American courts. There was a lot of discussion whether George W. Bush and Dick Cheney would be able to visit Europe because they actually are concerned about Interpol possible arrest warrants.
And George Tenet as well.
Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, years after the September 11th, 1973 coup d'etat that ended up killing 30,000 Chileans and put many, many more in prison. Pinochet was arrested when he went to Europe because of war crimes charges. These things matter. They may not matter inside the UK, or they may, but they certainly have implications for all of these officials. That's important because that's about accountability. Go ahead, Dr. Boyle.
Yes, I was saying, so my advice is that the British lawyers put together a complaint against Blair and the rest of them and file it with the International Criminal Court. And indeed, last fall, the ICC prosecutor, Ben Suda, did say she was opening an investigation into the Bush Jr. et al. Policy of extraordinary rendition because they had committed these crimes in ICC member states. And yeah, what John was saying, sure, I was involved in that effort to scare Bush out of Geneva. A parliamentarian there sent a letter to the Swiss federal prosecutor saying that based on my complaint, Bush should be prosecuted for torture, at least if he shows up in Geneva. That got back to Bush, and he didn't travel there. We went after Cheney twice in Canada, but the Harper administration intervened and aborted those legal proceedings. Although I kind of doubt Justin Trudeau might do the same thing. Yes, I was a prosecutor in the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal against Bush and the rest of them for this type of activity and got them convicted. And then also the proceedings against Bush and Blair for starting the war against Iraq. John is right. Pinochet, there's the excellent ruling by the British House of Lords in that case on the basis of the torture convention to which Britain is a party, saying that Pinochet can be extradited on the basis of the torture convention. So, right, we have universal jurisdiction to go after Blair, Straw, Blunkett, the heads of MI5, MI6, anywhere in the world. You know, but I think the British lawyers have to step up to the plate here and review these two reports and put that complaint together and then file it with the International Criminal Court and also with the British courts, since it is a party to the Rome Statute. And Britain is supposed to have domestic implementing legislation for Rome statutory crimes. And they are also party to the torture convention. So I guess if I were a British human rights lawyer today, I'd be salivating over these two reports and getting my complaint together. I'm happy to help them out if they want that. But, you know, this is their responsibility. I've done my part over here in the United States.
Well, we were joined from Urbana, Illinois by Francis Boyle, a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and the author of the book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East Before and After September 11th. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Angela Merkel is in trouble. The German chancellor's coalition partner has threatened to withdraw from the government if she doesn't solve Germany's immigration crisis by this weekend, while Italy's new populist government said that it would not accept any refugees back from Germany. Merkel said today that if an immigration agreement isn't hammered out this weekend, the very future of the European Union is in doubt. We're joined from Berlin by Diani Barreto. She's an activist and a journalist there. Welcome back, Diani.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Diani, just how serious of a crisis is this? Is Merkel overstating it when she says that if it's not fixed in the very near future, that the European Union is actually in doubt?
She has not minced her words. She said that this is the destiny question for the EU, and she doesn't tend to exaggerate lightly. And many diplomats are commenting in the press here that this is the mother of all European summits. And she's under a lot of pressure right now because she has been given an ultimatum by her conservative coalition allies to drum up some magical pan-European approach to deal with the asylum seekers who reach Germany but have been registered elsewhere. Now, again, I'm thinking this is a manufactured crisis because the immigration or the asylum seeker numbers are down 96%. Compared to when they were peaking in 2015, 2016. So it's not really a crisis on the ground. It's just we have political parties and agendas rearing their ugly head in Europe because it's all completely pretty much shifted to the right. And Merkel knows that she's literally the defender of what we know as the liberal parliamentarian democracies as we know it. And if she's gone, everything is inevitably going to shift to the right. And all the diplomats know this. So they seem to be on their best, best will forward in order to help her hammer out these 10 bilateral agreements with the European countries. They had a meeting on the weekend with 16 of the European Union members and now the 28 at this monster summit going on. And it seems like it's going to be an all-nighter tonight, they say. They're just sitting down for dinner now. And it now seems like Italy's saying, well, no, we're not going to cooperate. And that's a very difficult thing right now because Merkel has to keep it all together.
And in fact, in the last meeting, Hungary and Poland and a couple of other countries didn't cooperate either, did they?
Well, not really. And but now we have the European Union President Tusk really trying to say we all have to agree on this, together. It has to be a multilateral approach. If not, it's going to be like a domino effect. If, you know, one country does a unilateral approach, what her Merkel's conservative ally, if they're going to start turning people back at the border, then other countries can do the same, and it's going to have a horrible, devastating effect on migration or, you know, asylum policies in Europe. Of course, they didn't finish and hammer out all these things back in 2015 when Italy was struggling with the influx of refugees. I understand that. But it's also maybe very difficult to hammer out that kind of an agreement in the space of 2 days.
We have Italy and Turkey, Greece, the Mediterranean countries. You know, that's the point of disembarkment. That's where people are landing. They took the most in terms of burden. Germany under Merkel, and Merkel's popularity rating at that time was about 70%. It was quite high. Germany had an openness to refugees, migrants, people seeking refuge. Germany also had a labor shortage and needed skilled workers, and many of the people coming, especially from, say, Syria, actually were middle class and skilled people. But now here we are 3 years later, Yanni, and the backlash that's been sort of organized by right-wing, populist, nationalist, in some cases fascist or semi-fascist forces, more or less has changed the political climate, at least among the political leaders. And so, as you pointed out, even though the refugee flow today is a trickle, these different right-wing political parties have basically put a gun to Merkel's head and saying, you must solve this. And the 10 bilateral agreements are Merkel's way of trying to solve it. But what do those bilateral agreements actually do? What do they say?
Well, essentially, this is a very, very large, very ambitious project, which she's trying to assuage the fears that, you know, this, as you mentioned, the southern nations of Europe, that they're going to be stuck with this influx. No, they're trying to deter migration and the human traffickers, and they want to have disembarkation centers, which sounds a bit ominous, and it's not even sure if this is in alignment with the UN and human rights, because, yeah, you don't know what's going to happen at these centers. They're going to be obviously in either in the Mediterranean or in Africa. They want to engage also with African countries, so they might be keen, you know, with European funds in order to set up these third countries like they did in Turkey, in order to stem or to maintain the asylum seekers or the refugees there, like Turkey took in millions. This is up, and of course it has to be approved by the UN and the international agency that about deals with migration, for example, and if this is in tune with human rights and the legality of housing people in the middle of the sea. And at the same time, the EU wants to up its Frontex border water, maritime force to 10,000 strong. It's all about forest protection right now and border protection, and that's what they're all probably going to agree on. More practicalities than that, I don't see that they can actually manage this time around, and maybe just pretty much all agree that they can agree that reform is necessary, and it's going to look like some sort of border strengthening of the borders, basically, and to stem the migration to Europe by any means necessary.
We're speaking with Diane Barreto. She's an activist and a journalist in Berlin. She's telling us about the currently being held meeting of EU leaders to talk about immigration. Diane, what is the least that can come out of this this summit and still be deemed a success?
I think, again, as if they manage on this disembarkation centers, this is gaining popularity here in Europe with the leaders, they pretty much unanimously. I think that's what's probably going to come out of this. It's too early to tell. They've just started today. She gave a very impassioned speech today for Merkel in the German parliament. And it should be noted that her coalition partners of the Christian, the CSU, this character, Seehofer, the interior minister, it might be responsible for taking her down, because he's trying to, you know, toe to the far right because he's lost too many votes for the absolute majority, which they've maintained for 70 years, and they've been the kingmaker for 70 years. And so he's trying to cater to this clientele that has migrated from his party to the far right. They have elections in October, and they're actually, which all the Germans unanimously here think it is very, very dangerous to cater to that kind of populist sentiment. So we will see. He gave her until the 1st of July to come out with some, you know, concrete European, because she's insisting on multilateralism. He wants unilateralism. So we will see. But the stakes are very, very high, and it seems that many, many diplomats have spoken off the record today saying that this could be it. Not so much the Merkel's government, but what, you know, liberal democracy in Europe is going to look like.
Yeah. And again, it's a small right-wing Bavarian party. In order to get the a majority government, Merkel from the Christian Democrats had to include a minority party. And now this person is saying we must act unilaterally because they have a right-wing base, a very, very far right-wing base. We have about less than 2 minutes, but, you know, the whole concept of disembarkation, meaning you embark from somewhere and you're going to be disembarked somewhere else. When you go back and look at and this is what they're talking about. The right wing is talking about setting up these zones in Africa so that refugees will be returned to African countries, which of course don't have the resources either, maybe less equipped to handle an influx of refugees. But when you look at something called, say, the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, some of the subtitles of that slave trade was regions of embarkation and disembarkation. In other words, it comes from Europe's engagement in Africa's slave trade. The same language, the same terminology, perhaps some of the same venues are being employed now in response, as Diani is saying, to a manufactured crisis. This is not a real crisis because, as she's pointing out, 96% reduction in the influx of asylum seekers since 2015. Mm-hmm. Pure politics, right-wing politics, just like what we're seeing here in the USA.
Not only that, they're also catering. I mean, this is work, the Trump effect, that kind of language. It was absolutely unacceptable here to call people vermin, you know, vile names, dehumanize them. This is now a commonality here in Europe as well. And it's taken, that's how the Italians managed to make it into power. And so this is also very scary that we have this Trump effect here as well, and that, either, as you said, they're holding a gun to liberal democracy's head right now with a manufactured crisis. It's scary indeed.
Before World War II, John, all of continental Europe was fascist. Let's not forget that.
Sure, it was.
It wasn't just Italy
and
Germany. It was all of continental Europe. Xenophobia is the gateway to this dangerous, dangerous political phenomena.
I wish we could talk about it more, but we're out of time. We were joined from Berlin by Diani Barreto. She's an activist and a journalist there. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Chinese President Xi Jinping told visiting U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis that China, quote, will not give even 1 inch of territory, unquote, in the Pacific Ocean. Mattis's meeting with Xi comes as relations between the two countries have been marred by a trade war and by both militaries viewing each other with increased suspicion. We're joined from Madison, Wisconsin, by historian and author Alfred McCoy. He is the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and he's also the author of the book In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Professor, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So tell us, what really was the purpose of this meeting? I think everybody in the world knew that Mattis and Xi Jinping weren't going to agree on anything substantive, that Mattis's demands were on the provocative side. What was supposed to happen here?
That's an interesting question. I think what has happened is that they have articulated their positions, i.e. that Mattis has insisted that China's presence in the South China Sea, those seven militarized islands, represent a fundamental challenge to freedom of navigation. The United States is going to press its patrols. It is going to insist that the South China Sea is an international waterway subject to laws and convention that govern that. In other words, free movement of U.S. military vessels sailing well within the limits of those island bases that China is carving out in the South China Sea. And President Xi Jinping's countervailing statement that China won't give up 1 inch of territory, that's a reference not to some vague Pacific holdings, but to those seven island bases in the South China Sea. And beneath those, the kind of confrontational positions, neither side giving way, is, I think, a deeper geopolitical struggle for dominion, not only over Asia-Pacific, but indeed global dominion. Look, the U.S. strategy for the past 140 years, the critical issue in U.S. strategy has been the defense of the United States in the Pacific. We stabilized our Atlantic position in the late 19th century. Since that time, the critical challenge has been the U.S. position in the Pacific. Initially, we tried to resolve that by taking Hawaii, taking the Philippines. That didn't work because that placed us in Japan's home waters. That culminated in the Pacific War, our war with Japan. After the war, the United States resolved that geopolitical conundrum by laying down a chain of island bases. We took over 100 bases from the Japanese Imperial Army and Navy, and they became our bases, bases in South Korea, bases in the Philippines, and then a strategic alliance with Australia. And so along that Pacific littoral, that became the fulcrum of U.S. geopolitical power, granting us absolute dominion over the Pacific and thus security for the United States and the North American continent, and a position to project our power across the Eurasian landmass and contain Russia and China throughout the Cold War and the years that followed. China's got a very different geopolitical position. They're essentially adopting a land strategy through the One Belt, One Road strategy of unifying three continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa, into a world island with a grid of gas pipelines, oil pipelines, rails, roads, tunnels, industrial and primary production enclaves that turn that vast landmass into which is about 70% of the world's economy and 70% of the world's population, into a unified terrain. At the same time, China is trying to slice through the circles of steel the United States has laid down between NATO and those Pacific Rim bases throughout the Cold War. Mutual defense pacts, the Sixth Fleet in the Mediterranean, the Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf, the Seventh Fleet in the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean, trying to slice through those circles of steel, cut the U.S. geopolitical dominion over Eurasia by building bases in the South China Sea, now acquiring a base in East Africa, and potentially acquiring a base at Gwadar in Pakistan and Hambantota in Sri Lanka. And by challenging the United States dominion over its encircling waters in the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean, China hopes to cut the U.S. strategic dominion over Eurasia and thus marginalize the United States, kind of confine us to North America, and build its geopolitical power, becoming the successor global hegemon to the United States. So that's what's at stake. It's a struggle for global dominion, nothing more, nothing less.
That's the voice of Professor Alfred McCoy. He's a professor, also an author. Professor McCoy, we're talking about James Mattis's trip to China. Mattis spoke before the Naval War College graduates about 2 weeks ago. I want to read a couple sentences from his speech to them and then ask you to comment. He says the third category, after he talks about the confrontation with Russia, is that of political will, and that is a potential rivalry with China harboring long-term designs to rewrite the existing global order. The Ming Dynasty appears to be their model, albeit in a more muscular manner, demanding other nations become tribute states, kowtowing to Beijing, espousing One Belt, One Road, when this diverse world has many belts and many roads, and attempting to replicate on the international stage their authoritarian domestic model, militarizing the South China Sea features while using predatory economics of piling massive debt on others. He also goes on later in the speech to say that the Chinese authoritarian domestic model, as he calls it, will certainly be exported to other countries. In other words, bringing back the idea in a new iteration of the export of revolution. Anyway, what's your comment about his orientation there before the Naval War College?
Okay, what he's putting together in that statement, I think, is a subtext, okay, that most Americans aren't aware of. In the aftermath of World War II, when we stood like a titan astride the ruined globe that emerged from that conflict that not only killed 50 million people, but ravaged much of the industrial world, the United States used its extraordinary, unprecedented global power to do two things. First of all, we laid down, if you will, the rock-ribbed realpolitik of global dominion, those military bases, the naval fleets, the strategic bombers, all the rest that I described. But the United States did something that was rather extraordinary for a world power. We also began constructing a liberal international order. We presided over the conference that created the United Nations. At the Bretton Woods, we laid down a structure for shared global prosperity by the creation of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. That within the United Nations, we created an international court that is linked to it intimately, that was meant to propagate a rule of law. And subsequently, we have created international organizations like the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, that attempt to order the world and govern it by an international rule of law. And it is a bold vision of shared global governance grounded in clear rules. And what Mattis is describing is that China is challenging that in the most fundamental way possible. For example, in 2016, at the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, the Philippines sued China, claiming that some of those bases in the South China Sea were infringing in the Philippine maritime zone. And the Permanent Court of Arbitration ruled slam dunk win for the Philippines. The Permanent Court said that the China's artificial islands gave it, they were not territory. It gave China no rights to the seabed, to the sea surrounding those islands. China just dismissed the decision out of hand. And so Mattis is correct. China is not only on the ascent as a global power, but China is also fundamentally challenging that liberal international order. And so there are some serious issues at stake, not only the future of U.S. global power, but indeed the future of those liberal principles of the international rule of law, shared global governance that the United States created in the aftermath of World War II. And so there are some real issues at stake, and I think Mattis is, in a way, has captured them in that statement.
And in terms of the Trump so-called trade war, which from day to day changes in terms of what the real position is of the U.S. government, also designed for geostrategic advantage or simply really Trump trying to advantage some American industries and, of course, play to his political base? We have about 60 seconds left.
It's playing to political base, and almost every sober commentator, every student of international trade argues that Trump's trade initiatives are absolutely counterproductive. And they are doing more than the Chinese are doing to render the fabric of that liberal international order that the United States constructed in the aftermath of World War II and has maintained on a bipartisan basis in the 70 years since. Donald Trump's policies on trade, above all, are accelerating U.S. decline as a global power and ultimately allowing China, which poses, by the way, as a nation committed to international trade, encouraging, facilitating China's rise.
Professor, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Madison, Wisconsin, by historian and author Alfred McCoy. He's the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He's also the author of the book In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.